Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why Fox News has launched a Spanish language service.
And how an influx of black voters might affect the outcomes of the election in Arizona.
But first, there has been some rare good news in the battle against opioid overdose deaths. They're dropping pretty sharply. For years now, fentanyl has been a scourge in the battle against opioid addiction, killing tens of thousands of people across the country. The drug is incredibly potent. The phrase "one pill can kill" has become synonymous with it. But now across the country, we're seeing a dramatic improvement in efforts to reduce the devastating impact of this drug and others, and the reasons remain cloudy. So what does this drop look like here in Arizona and what might be behind it? Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association, is here to shed some light. Good morning, Will.
Good morning and happy Pledge Week.
Happy fun drive. Thanks for coming in. And I want to start with the numbers, Will. You and your colleague, Alan Williams, crunched the data here in Arizona compared to the rest of the country. What did you find?
Yeah. So as you said at the top, we are making progress nationally at lowering the number of opioid deaths, really mostly fentanyl. Across the country, but it's not evenly distributed. So we see a lot, really most of the states in the Midwest and in the eastern part of the U.S. and the South are really having substantial and sometimes dramatic drops. So, for example, you know, Arkansas, Louisiana have seen drops, really pretty, North Carolina, big drops in opioid deaths. In Arizona, we're at about a wash. It looks like it's peaked a little bit and at least it's not getting worse in Arizona. But then there's other states like Alaska and Nevada, Washington, and Oregon that are still having more and more opioid deaths from fentanyl. So, as you said, it's a little bit nebulous as to there's some theories as to why this, you know, why it's different in the West than the rest of the country. We can get into that if you want.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a moment. So this was those kind of numbers you're talking about are the numbers over the last several years, looking at maybe up to 2023. You also looked at the 2024 data, which is where some of these major drops are really materializing. These are not finalized numbers yet, but it looked like it's pointing like toward more of a drop in Arizona in this year.
Yes, slightly. But remember, from a huge peak, I mean, it's been a 20-year run-up in these opioid deaths. In those early years, right after 2000, it was mostly prescribed opioids. And then over the last 10 years, it's really been street fentanyl.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what the difference might be between some of those states that you mentioned that have seen very large drops in opioid overdose deaths and some states like ours. What are the major theories out there, Will?
The dominant theory is something I read in Scientific American. It's not a study, but it's more of a hypothesis that the Midwest and the eastern states had a really bad fentanyl crisis before the western states did. And so those states, like their Medicaid agencies, their law enforcement, the connection with the justice system, the agencies at the state, local, and county level began to coordinate and collaborate to get ahead of this fentanyl crisis in the Midwest and eastern states because it was such a crisis. And meanwhile, the western states were kind of sitting back saying, hey, this is a Midwest and east place problem. And the western states were slower to get these interventions underway. And so that is a working theory. Although in my blog, I sort of invite academics to really dive into the details and figure out, is there an association between how states are using their opioid settlement money and the results that you're seeing in the field?
Right, right. We'll get into that more in a moment. I have to ask you about the role of naloxone here, which has been a game changer, right, in this. It can reverse an overdose as it's happening, basically. How has that looked here?
Well, it's across the country, it's gotten a lot better. So naloxone is it's something you just inject into the nose. And if someone who's having an opioid crisis, it reverses that almost immediately, very quickly. So it's in the hands of law enforcement, firefighters, first responders, and now even bystanders in Arizona. You could get naloxone at a regular drugstore or pharmacy without a prescription now. So making that more available, having it in people's purses and people's pockets, and have it with law enforcement and EMS is making a real difference. I liken it to the bottom of the waterfall. So you're catching, with naloxone, you're catching people at the bottom of the waterfall. They're in an opioid crisis, and you can reverse that and save their life right then and there. The real key to this whole thing is getting people at the top of the waterfall before they come off. And that really is dependent on getting people into treatment for their opioid use disorder with medication-assisted drugs, so that they don't go off that waterfall and you don't need to use that naloxone at the end.
Right, right. And there are some theories about harm reduction programs and their impact here, things like needle exchange programs, safe consumption sites, fentanyl test strips, right? I want to ask you about state-level interventions and what else you think might need to be done here, or maybe is being done here, that might accelerate this drop in opioid overdose deaths.
Yeah, so with the settlement money, about 40% of that opioid settlement money goes to the county health departments and county level. So Pima County is doing a terrific bunch of things. Maricopa County is as well. Where we have some real opportunities is with the state portion of that settlement money, which has been underused. You could do another story about how it was used to balance the budget last year, which I don't think was appropriate, but that's what ended up happening. One of the things I'd really love to see is for that opioid settlement money to go to Access, our state Medicaid agency, so they can start paying for or actually removing the prior authorization that they have in place for a drug called naltrexone and buprenorphine, which are long-acting, and in case of naltrexone, an injectable opioid antagonist, so that you're not relying on methadone clinics for your treatment, that's a daily thing. So I'd love to see us get the prior auth, which is required with our Medicaid agency, to allow people to get assistance that's long acting and not a daily drug, to get them off of the cravings that they have and they can be weaned off. So prevention, the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is true.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association, joining us to talk more about this story. Will, thanks so much.
Our pleasure.
Fox News has launched a new Spanish-language venture. Fox Noticias started airing this month for an hour a day on the Fox Deportes channel. It'll focus on news, sports, and culture. With me to talk about this move and what might be behind it is political consultant Mike Madrid. He's with the firm Grassroots Lab and is also the co-host of the Latino Vote podcast. And Mike, what do you make, first off, of the fact that Fox News is undertaking this endeavor?
Well, in many ways, it makes perfect sense. And in other ways, it's kind of perplexing. The first is, the Latino market, the Hispanic market is exploding. The population is growing at a very, very fast pace, not just in the population, but with voters. And this is happening at a time where Fox News's viewership is aging and aging out rather rapidly. So as a matter of market share, it makes perfect sense for them to kind of both open and find broader markets, especially with a younger demographic. But perhaps the most perplexing part is, why Spanish? Their actual largest increases on their English mediums are with Hispanic viewers currently in English. The fastest growing segment of the Latino community is the third and fourth generation, which overwhelmingly are consuming media in English. So this move into Spanish media is a little bit peculiar insofar as the Spanish speaking market is actually shrinking quite rapidly. And this further diversifies an already balkanized market, which is just kind of scattered. And the question becomes, is this a market play? Is this a political play or some combination of the two?
What does your gut tell you it is?
My gut tells me it's a long-term market play for a couple of reasons. The first, again, as I just mentioned, is the Spanish-speaking audience amongst Latinos in this country is shrinking. That's true of Latino voters as well. And not only that, but the fact that the market is becoming so fragmented, it would be an extraordinarily expensive and laborious undertaking to kind of try to speak to a small, fast shrinking segment of the market that is amongst the most partisanized for Democrats. with the least likely to yield any effective outcomes for Republicans. So that doesn't seem to add up, but I guess you could also make the argument that everything matters, every vote matters, and even though it's expensive and inefficient, it's worth the investment because the stakes are so high.
Well, and as you and I have talked in the past, and others have talked about this as well, even though Latino voters traditionally and this year expected as well to heavily favor Democratic candidates, the numbers and the margins aren't as big as they once were. So I wonder, you know, kind of alluding to what you were saying earlier, is this maybe a longer term play to maybe, you know, nudge that trend along a little bit?
Well, that's exactly right. And again, no one is suggesting that the Latino vote will, you know, majority vote for Republicans, but they don't need that. This is a play for margins, as it is with all voter groups. A 2 or 3% increase with the Hispanic vote could have tectonic impacts in who is going to be the next president of the United States. So from that perspective, yeah, this would be a bold, but again, expensive and laborious project.
Do you think that media companies, not specifically Fox News, but maybe including Fox News, understand the difference between Hispanic viewers and Spanish language viewers?
That's a great question. I would say over the past 30 years, the answer to that would be no. But I think as the market is maturing and things like the Latino population is exploding, but you know, Univision, the dominant Spanish language medium, is watching its viewership collapse, you're beginning to understand that the Latino electorate, the Latino population, is far, far more nuanced than it was probably 30 years ago. The great growth of Latino and the Latino population is happening with third and fourth generation voters, as opposed to decades ago when it was largely an immigrant community that was Spanish dominant, that was consuming most of its media in Spanish. So things have changed. They've changed markedly. And even though the quote unquote Latino market is growing sizably bigger, the Spanish part of that market is getting smaller. So, you know, I think the jury's out as to whether or not the media companies are capturing this accurately. And it does make one wonder whether the objective here is simple market share. To me, that's a better answer than trying to impact an election in the next 2.5 weeks with such a significant investment. If the benefits are both and they get, you know, both happen, then all the better. But it's hard to see a media company making this kind of an investment for something this short term.
Do you get the sense that Latino viewers and Latino voters, especially as you say, are more and more speaking English? Are they looking for media and news outlets that are catering to them in some way? Or are they just sort of interested in watching the news and hearing the news, regardless of whether it's targeted at their community or not?
That's been a debate that I think is being decided on the side of, yes, there is a cultural component to the Latino audience that is unique, that is impactful, and that is looking for more of what we call big entertainment, right? The big bands, the splashy entertainment venues. That is something that appears to be lasting generationally. Point to Bad Bunny, for example, yeah. Not just the largest Latino artist, but the largest artist nationally, even with English-speaking audiences. In many ways, Mark, what we're seeing is the dominant American culture assimilating towards Latino culture as much as Latino culture is assimilating into American culture, because the size of the growth is watching these two communities meld into one. And the differentiator there is not simply just English news or news as we've seen it. There's absolutely a cultural component that incorporates the music, the entertainment, the tone, the style, of sort of the intergenerational Latino citizen, resident. And so we are seeing more cultural aspects to consuming all media, including the news.
That's interesting. So if you were in charge of Fox News and Fox Noticias, how would you define whether or not this venture is successful or not?
I'm not a media executive, but yeah. I think the viewership is obviously the main metric. But the real question is, a multi-year strategy that would see transitioning some of these recently migrated Spanish-speaking viewers, which is who they're clearly targeting, transitioning either themselves and or their second-generation children to the Fox English-speaking brand. Fox News, again, their viewership is so much older than the overall viewership in the country that unless they do start to bring in new viewers, branding with a new generation of viewers, they're going to hit a demographic cliff. So this seems to be part of that longer term strategy. And I think the only way to ask whether or not it's a success is if they are capably branding the Fox product in the minds of these younger voters.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Mark, always a pleasure to be with you.
Mike Madrid is a political consultant with the firm Grassroots Lab. He's also co-host of the Latino Vote podcast. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Election day is 2 weeks from today, and all eyes are on swing states like Arizona as we head into this home stretch. In 2020, President Joe Biden won Arizona by about 10,000 votes. Not a lot. And while a lot of attention has been given to the all-important Latino vote here, there are about 250,000 voting-age Black people in the state. And our next guest says how they will vote, or if they will vote, is not a given. Adam Mahoney is a climate environment reporter for Capital B, a national newsroom reporting on the Black community across the country. He first came to Arizona to report on the growing Black population here last year. And this year, he came back to find out how they might impact this election. I spoke with him more about what he found.
When we look at Black political participation in Arizona compared to the other six swing states in this election cycle, actually, Black folks in Arizona have voted at a lower rate than every state except Wisconsin since the 2016 election. And a lot of that, which we found through interviews and talking to folks, both everyday voters, as well as like researchers and political experts, is, you know, the fact that a lot of folks who are moving to Arizona, they're moving from states and places where they may have been disillusioned by the both local, state, and, you know, federal government for several reasons. So you're like kind of moving to Arizona as not, you know, necessarily a last resort, but you have been pushed and pulled in so many different ways where you might not have the same level of trust with the electoral system because you've felt like you've been let down in the places that you've come from.
That's really interesting. So it kind of gets at the reasons why many Black people have moved here in recent years. And as you've reported in the past, the numbers have really, really gone up fast in terms of the Black population in Arizona. It's still about 5% of the total population, but many, many more Black people are here and are expected to vote, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, since 2010, well over 70,000 Black folks have moved in just to like the Maricopa County area. But that number is even larger for the state. And like you said, you know, the Black population is still relatively small. But when we think about the ways that, you know, historically, Black folks have kind of been able to move the needle in elections, Arizona does really seem like a place where if you did have, you know, those 70,000 folks voting and voting in a particular way, that would definitely shift the outcome of, you know, the state's electoral votes.
Right. So let's talk about the difference then between the Black populations in, you know, cities like Chicago or New York or somewhere in the Midwest or something like that, as opposed to the Black population here. It seems like there's a question of the organization, the lack of community, lack of roots.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, 100%, that has been the issue that folks brought up to me in conversations is, you know, compared to a place like Chicago or Detroit, where there are historic Black communities where Black folks have been concentrated in the same neighborhoods for generations now, you know, they're operating under the same systems and similar understandings of the world around them. It allows for a greater consensus in terms of like your preferences, both politically and also when we're thinking about building like community power, right? And community organizations. And in, you know, the Phoenix metro area in Arizona more broadly, it is a newer population, right? The growth started maybe in the 1980s and it has picked up in the last decade or so. But folks here are not living in the same kind of ecosystems that they would be in other cities, right? There's not necessarily a singular Black neighborhood or Black community in the way that most cities operate under. So it's harder, one, for when people move in, they said it's harder to find folks, right? And to be around other Black people and to understand maybe the issues and the ways that maybe different electoral issues are affecting Black life here. So that just makes it a little bit more difficult maybe to participate and the system, if you're not coming in with that understanding and you're not a part of a community that maybe has a unified voice, and that's not to say that all Black folks vote in a monolithic way.
Right.
But it does make it a little bit harder to become politically active because you have to go out of your way to figure out the mechanisms to go about that.
And I want to ask you about that lack of monolithic voting in a moment. But one more question on this front first, Adam. You talk about the lack of roots in the piece, but you also talk about some folks who seem to think that the fact that Black people here are not as discriminated against, not as exposed to the kind of levels of segregation they might have been in the cities they came from, there's almost less reason for them to organize, or less community to push against.
Yeah, that is also something that came up. I mean, when you look at the Black folks that are moving in, and then just generally the people who are able to migrate across states, you're usually coming in at a higher social class, higher economic class, maybe than the population of the folks who are longtime residents in cities. And that's definitely true for Black people moving in to Arizona, and just more generally, like Black folks, the average income in Arizona is you know, above average when we're looking at across the country. And if you're coming to a place where maybe you feel like you now have the resources that you were lacking before and you don't want to kind of rock the boat, that is also something that came up in conversations of you know, being a reason why people might be less likely to participate.
That's really interesting. Okay, so let's talk about the voting patterns of the Black population here in recent elections. We mentioned, right, their participation might be lower than it is among the same populations in different states, but we should not, as you mentioned, assume that Black voters are a monolith. How have they voted in Arizona in recent elections?
Yeah, I mean, overwhelmingly, Black folks still vote Democrat in Arizona, but compared to other states, compared to, you know, other Western states, places like California, Black voters here do vote Republican at a higher rate. And actually, in the 2020 election, about half of Arizona's Black voters were either, you know, identifying as Republican or Independent. So it does go in ways that maybe historically we're not attuned to when we think about the Black vote. That's not to say that it's like, you know, a 50-50 split by any means, but it does complicate the narrative of building like a unified, quote unquote, like Black political power or a Black community, because there are, to a healthy extent, there are differing opinions amongst folks in Arizona that, from my reporting and conversations, you know, don't exist in the same way or as intensely in other states.
Okay. So talk about issues a little bit for us, Adam, here. I mean, you talked to many Black voters here in Arizona. What did they say matters most to them?
Yeah, there were several major issues that folks, you know, continuously brought up. One, climate change, extreme heat, fears around drought and access to water. Another one was housing. And that's a really interesting one because that has actually been one of the biggest drivers of migration to Arizona, right, is that ability to, you know, purchase a home. But in the last decade or so, as there has been that influx of migration, both Black folks and folks of all races, it has actually, you know, led to an increase in housing costs, in addition to a lot of, you know, different private investors coming in and swooping up properties. So there's been fears about access to housing and gentrification, in addition to reproductive rights, access to abortion. And another large one was fears around, for families in particular, fears around the public education system and the way that the, you know, state voucher system has kind of upended what folks in Arizona know as public education and the way that is funded.
So the big question then, I guess, to end with, and obviously you don't have a crystal ball here, but how do you think the Black population, this much larger than it used to be Black population here in Arizona, might influence this upcoming election? As you mentioned, we are an all important swing state.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, everyone came out to vote, the Black vote would be of singular importance. But based off of conversations, you know, I talked to a lot of folks who just are not necessarily, for several reasons, not necessarily excited or maybe fully interested in voting in this upcoming election. And without that full participation, it might not have as much sway as Black folks could in the state of Arizona.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Adam Mahoney, climate and environment reporter for Capital B, joining us. Adam, thanks for coming on. Thanks for your reporting on this. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The World Series gets underway later this week, but unlike last year, it will not include the Diamondbacks. That does not mean, however, that there is not still drama involving the team this postseason. The dispute between the D-backs and Maricopa County over the present and possible future of Chase Field continues. And with me now to talk about where things stand is Sasha Hupka of the Arizona Republic, who's been writing about this. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So it seems like maybe there's a difference of opinion in terms of where things are between the team and the county. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's probably fair to say. This is a really interesting behind-the-scenes disagreement between these two entities. Essentially, what happened is that the county sent the Diamondbacks a letter with a counteroffer to an initial proposal that money-wise was very far from what the team had in that initial document. And they had indicated that they were frustrated by recent public remarks by the team on ongoing negotiations, which were things just to the effect of negotiations going well. Team leaders were not happy with that counteroffer, and they also said that they were frustrated that the ongoing negotiations had become public, that the county had sent this letter that was a public record and that I obtained, and everything kind of went downhill from there.
Right. Well, and it sounds as though since then, as you say, it's gone downhill. Like, how far downhill has it gone? Like, where do we stand right now?
Well, I think a good kind of example that encapsulates this is that the county's letter and then its subsequent publication prompted phone calls to county supervisors from a real estate developer who has been involved in negotiations. His name is Andrew Cohen. He and the supervisors described these calls differently, but what's really clear is that these were not happy conversations. Mm. Cohen resigned from his position on the Maricopa County IDA, which is not really related to Chase Field, but it's a board that helps private borrowers obtain financing for projects that benefit the public, things like affordable housing. But it was a very public move and a very public break.
So where does that leave things now? I mean, obviously, you know, the team has talked about the need for a lot of repairs at Chase Field. The county has said we're not looking to do that. The team is kind of in charge of that sort of thing. Is the team looking to make those improvements? Are they still potentially looking to leave Chase Field?
Well, I think that for the team, they've told me previously that they don't see a point in putting a whole lot of money into a facility that they don't have a guarantee that they're going to stay in past 2027, which is when their lease ends. From the county side, they say that there's some progress being made in talks. The Diamondbacks say that there's been no conversations at all since this very public break, or at least not with top team leaders. Obviously, those are two very different statements, but I think what is abundantly clear from the team side at this point is that they're not really interested in seriously having talks with the county's current board of supervisors. It's worth noting that all of the seats on that board are up for election in the next few weeks, and three of the five people are definitely going to be new faces to the county. But it's unclear if a new board will be more favorable to the team somehow than the current one is.
Right. It kind of sounds like maybe the team is trying to hedge its bets a little bit and maybe wait out the current board and hope that the new members, whoever they are, might be more likely to strike a deal, or at least, you know, in the team's mind anyway, you know, maybe negotiate in better faith.
I think that probably sums up where they're at internally from everything that I'm gathering. I will say that the other thing that's kind of unclear at the moment is where the city of Phoenix and the state might lie in all of this. We know that the city was involved in some early conversations with the county, but those kind of seem to have died out. But either the city or the state potentially could have roles to play in terms of getting the team the funding mechanisms that they will need to renovate and redevelop the ballpark. However, Chase Field itself is key to all of this. So at some point, the team is going to hash out a solution with the county. It's just unclear when that will be. And there's this time crunch happening. You know, 2027 sounds really far away, maybe to you or I, But in terms of stadium ballpark agreements, that's actually very close.
Yeah, just ask the Oakland A's about that. So, I guess what are you looking for maybe after the November election? We'll know who the new members of the board are. Are there particular sort of tea leaves that you're going to be looking to read to see, okay, this group is more amenable to working with the D-backs, or no, this group is basically in the same place as the current board and maybe the city or state has to get involved, or maybe the team has to start looking for a new home?
I think that one of the first steps is certainly going to be asking the new supervisors, once they're actually elected, you know, what is their stance on this entire situation? Where are they at with it? And I suspect I might get some sort of statement to the effect of, oh, yes, we're going to talk with the team, you know, and kind of not say much of substance because they'll be so new and these conversations with them will be so preliminary. But I think just trying to kind of get a feel for that tone and also continuing to talk to the team and understanding from their perspective, where are the conversations at? One other thing I'll be really interested to see is, you know, are there any other third parties that are getting brought into the room? The county and the team seem to have some disagreement about Andrew Cohen and what his role was in these negotiations. We know that he has a long history of involvement in talks between the two entities dating back to 2018. But what everyone does agree on is that Cohen was involved, at least peripherally, in this round of talks. And so I'll be interested to see, you know, does he come back into the room, and do we see potentially other third parties coming into the room who are able to represent both of these interests, but maybe take some of the tension out of the conversation a little bit?
All right. Lots to certainly keep our eyes on going forward. That is Sasha Hupka with the Arizona Republic. Sasha, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. Along with Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Phoenix is no stranger to dubious honors. About 100 years ago, before we were famous for our seemingly endless streaks of 100-degree days or skyrocketing housing costs, the city was known as the last bastion of hope for tuberculosis patients. In the 1930s, scores of people battling this disease flocked to the valley, where the climate was believed to provide relief from TB's debilitating symptoms. Wealthy patients were treated in clinics, but many found refuge in a series of religious missions. These missions couldn't offer much in the way of formal medical procedures, but they did their best to make so-called lungers comfortable, or at least distract them from their illness. One of these missions was in Sunnyslope, and according to a local history buff named Ed Dobbins, this so-called desert mission also played an unlikely role in the history of ceramics.
The minister who ran the mission, Joseph Hillhouse, he was always out raising funds and finding things for people to do. He didn't want them sitting around all day. And one year he stopped in Hollister, Missouri, and that's where he saw this guy, Harold Herrine, selling pottery along the roadside, the very colorful pottery. And he talked to him, and he found out how it was made. And he found out that Herrine would go out to people and teach people how to make the pottery and sell them like a turnkey operation. So Hillhouse thought this would be a good thing for the people in Sunnyslope. And he asked Herrine if he would come out and show him how it's done.
And you say it was this turnkey operation. What was specific about this particular way of making pots?
Well, first of all, it was not made of pottery. It was made out of from cement. But he didn't use any molds. Most pottery would be made out of cement would have been used molds where you break open the two halves. So he patented a process that it was generally built on a wheel, like a potter's wheel, but without the foot pedal. He would start with a pile of wet sawdust covered with cheesecloth and put that on the wheel and then cover that over with a thick layer of concrete and then turn the wheel while he had a template that he would press against the concrete to get rid of the excess concrete to shape the outside of the bowl.
So before we get to the distinctive color element of this pottery, It does seem like one of its benefits is that it was made of incredibly tough material.
Yeah, lasts a long time. Yes, it does.
Yeah. And, but the distinctive quality of it is the color scheme.
Well, most of them are done in a variety of colors, from 1 to 8 or so. Very, very, very brightly colored and in swirls and different patterns. But the way they colored the pottery, he would make his own concrete slip and then grind minerals of different colors into that slip. So when it covered the pot, it would actually form right into the pot. And the raw minerals gave a very bright color.
Interesting. So it's not, it's different than some pottery where you're painting the dried pot. It's almost like he was dyeing the concrete.
Yeah, he would apply the different colors while he moved the pot. And he actually had a device for a patent that combined like 4 different colors at once, 2 to 4 different colors. So there's all kinds of combinations based upon the speed that the pot is being turned and the angle that it's being turned at and what combination of colors are being used. So there's a large variety of outcomes.
And the result of this, just speaking qualitatively, is a kind of, the word that comes to mind for me is trippy. It's this kind of trippy, almost.
Kind of wild looking pottery.
Yeah, kind of like a psychedelic series of patterns of colors kind of dripping and bleeding into each other.
Yeah, very nice. You know, the only thing I've read that he gave his inspiration for the colors on the pottery were the paintings of Maxfield Parrish.
Like very vibrant cloudbursts.
Yeah, kind of a dreamy look to them.
Yeah, sort of like a Garden of Eden kind of sensibility. Yeah. So Hill House is exposed to this form of pottery that Harreen has literally patented, it sounds like.
Right.
And he brings it out to Sunny Slope.
And it said that the people really took to it and they made a lot of pottery. They made it from 1935 to about 1939, about 4 years.
Uh-huh. And if I'm not mistaken, there's kind of an interesting irony here, right? Which is that it turned out that even though the patients started making the pottery as a way to pass the time while they were hopefully recovering from tuberculosis, there was some thought that the process of making the pottery might actually worsen the symptoms, right?
Right, yeah, because of the dust from the cement.
Right.
And they made it indoors for the most part.
But so as a result of these various factors, authentic Sunny Slope versions of the pots are particularly rare, right?
I think so, yes, because it's a little hard to tell because I'm pretty sure no one marked them. I only have one that I think might be from Sunny Slope. It has an old piece of masking tape on the bottom, and somebody wrote in Arizona. So it's not, you know, not the best provenance, but it's the best that I found so far.
Yeah.
So
how did you come to be interested in this?
Well, I bought a box of these pots from an antique dealer about 7 or 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he told me these were made in Sunny Slope during the 1930s. And so naturally I said, how do you know that? He said, well, you know, I found them here in Phoenix. So that I knew I needed a little bit better background than that. And so I started looking into it and found Harreen's name. And then I was able to trace him by 40 years later, was an artist, a painter in Albuquerque.
Okay.
The same name. So I figured maybe as he aged, he moved out here to the Southwest. And I found a research paper from about 20 years later from a scientific lab in Albuquerque about training moths how to detect high explosives. And that seemed like, it seemed a little offbeat, you know? So I thought maybe that had something. And the name Harreen, but a different first name, Frank Harreen, was one of the authors on that paper.
Uh-huh.
So I decided to contact that Frank Harreen and asked him whether his father ever made cement pottery. He said, yes, he did.
So the spirit of experimentation was passed down.
Yeah, right, yeah. So, but he was very happy to find someone finally that was really interested in it and doing some research on it. And we've become friends over here in the past 7 years.
So did Frank have any of the original pots?
He has 2, and he gave me one of them, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's very nice. Uh-huh. So we know one for sure was made by his father.
Yeah, so that's getting to be almost 100 years old.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
90 years, I guess you're right, yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
It looks good, too, for 100.
Yeah. Yeah, well, made out of cement, right? So they just seem like kind of the ultimate Phoenix artwork, you know, because it's always extreme circumstances to live out here in the desert.
Right, right.
But then you add the tuberculosis layer.
Right, yes. So, yeah, it comes from that era. But they actually tried, Horine tried to take it one step further and make the cement using desert sand, local desert sand.
Wow.
Apparently it didn't work. Okay. So, but other than that, it would have been great. It would have been even better.
Wow. Well, Ed Dobbins is a Phoenix history enthusiast, and thank you so much for telling us about this interesting corner of pottery history.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.